Hey, welcome to the Total Connector Show. My name is Keevan Devani. It was really a pleasure and honor to have had Brendan Quidham, the author of Bitcoin is a Decentralized Organism, Mycelium, a series of articles. You should definitely check it out on medium.com. And Hess McCook, I already had him a couple of times on my show, you know, really expert on his on the topics he wrote about and discussed, calculating Bitcoin's energy use, Bitcoin's mining economics, cost and sustainability of Bitcoin. So we together, we went really into the fascinating rabbit holes of Bitcoin, and you know, was really overdue to hear both of them share the knowledge, the wisdom, their perspectives and vision in connection with Bitcoin. And yeah, I hope you're going to love this as much as I did. I learned a lot. I'm sure you as my listeners will do too. And let me know your thoughts. Give me your feedback. I would really appreciate a positive review on iTunes, Apple, any other podcast platform. And yeah, thank you so much for support. Thanks so much for listening. And have fun. Thank you so much. Bye. Welcome to the Total Connector Show. My name is Keevan Devani. My very special guest, Brendan Quidham and Hess McCook. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming to my show. Late night, my time. How are you guys doing?
Brendan, yeah, no, Hess. Pretty good. Looks like we've covered three very distinct time zones. So congratulations to all parties.
Yeah, and actually, Ben Prentice excuses himself. He wanted to come on the show, definitely, but he's got promoted. Congratulations to him in his job. And I told him, you know, we can make this up maybe next time instead of, you know, rescheduling again. So he's really sorry he can't make it, but next time, hopefully. So, Brendan, let me start off with you. I loved your article on Mycelium. As I told you, that it's really great inspiration and extrapolation, if I may call that, you know, when it comes to Bitcoin. I want to ask you something straightforward. For a very, you know, provocatively deliberate question, is that why not you know, pick, for example, also a culture of ants, you know, ants, the insects? What would be the difference between mycelium and ants? And, you know, just break it down, and I want to have Hess take on that too.
Yeah, good question. And first of all, thanks for having me on. I'm super excited about the conversation, so appreciate that. I've listened to quite a few of your episodes, so yeah, happy to be here. So first off, the easy question, why mycelium and why not ants? And it's kind of an interesting question, right? I think it was Andreas who initially had the leafcutter ants. And the leafcutter ants were sort of a representation of the Bitcoin network, right? We're each an ant. And together, all the ants form what looks to be like one organism. A single ant will sacrifice himself for the greater good, and they sort of act automated in a way. And how is that different from mycelium? So I guess, why did I pick mycelium? Because I'm very interested in mycology. And so for me, that was just a natural thing. Like, I was steeped in mycology, so that was sort of the easy pick. But what are the differences? I'm not sure if I have like a good, hard, fast rule here. But when I think about mycelium, it's actually one organism. And the ants have separate units that act as a whole, whereas mycelium has a bunch of separate parts, but it's really all one biological being. And you can see this play out with like the giant honey mushroom in Western United States. It's unsure exactly how old, but it's around 2,000 years old. And it's the same DNA being reproduced. And so I think that's probably the main difference, is it's a single unit. Whereas ants, maybe individual units might have slightly different DNA, which would lead to evolution by natural selection. Whereas with mycelium, it actually upgrades itself over time. It absorbs genetic information and it learns from its interaction with its environment. So yeah, stressors force it to evolve. And, you know, that's why it's able to stay so relevant and so competitive in its ecosystem for thousands of years.
Great answer. I love that. So Hess, you've read Brendan's articles on mycelium?
Yes,
right?
Yes, I have. And I'm three quarters sold on on his article. So I definitely I definitely agree that Bitcoin does reflect mycelium, and I think Brandon's made a comment on Twitter. He's put out a tweet in the past that Bitcoin is politics, and nature is religion or something like that.
That's so exactly right.
I wouldn't stop at Bitcoin being mycelium. My stopping point is Bitcoin is literally nature itself. Nature manifested in money form, or energy manifested in money form, and nature is as nature does, and that's Bitcoin. But that's a very far out there broad generalization. I think the closest down subset from that would be mycelium for sure.
Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to because the thing is that the reason I asked about ants is that when it comes to incentivized behavior, or let's say, when there's a natural, you're talking about, like natural order, natural behavior, everything that is natural is sort of imprinted into your own, DNA, RNA, your mind, your consciousness. So do you think there's a correlation between, incentivized behavior, incentivized action, until, for example, human beings start taking action because of a need, because of a desire, and extrapolating that, to mycelium or even ants, is a desire imprinted already, or does it need to be created, the environmental conditions, let's say? You know where I'm getting at? Like, where can we find this process until, we as human beings, as a, even, let's say critical collective society start like really acting and interacting decentralized, so the purpose is still sort of fulfilled,
so for me, I think the first instinct of life and nature itself, the first underlying core instinct, is to survive, and secondly ensure that your genetics survive. So all beings will react in the context of nature, and they'll be incentivized by things that ensure their survival. So right now, Bitcoin is all share and aligned incentive, and a big aspect of that is our survival, and this is why I say stack sats for salvation, because just being involved in the ecosystem is, or for me at least, satisfying my desire to survive, when everything inevitably hits the fan.
I love that answer. And there's also a parallel here with the archetype that both Bitcoin, mycelium, the internet, dark energy, how our neurons are formed, this network archetype. It's something we observe in nature at the very, very grand scale. So if you look at a map of the universe, you can see how dark energy and matter interact, and it forms this mycelial web, this decentralized brain, essentially, a network archetype. And you can zoom all the way into our neurons, and it's the same archetype. And so what we're observing is that this pattern, it keeps popping up at different fractal layers. And it persists for so long, for billions of years. Right now, we've found mycelium on our planet, fossilized mycelium, 1.3 billion years ago, which is now the oldest complex life on our planet. So if we extrapolate what that means, it means this network archetype might have been the archetype that fostered complex life, which led to all the different evolutionary paths that we have today. And so if this network archetype persists and it's that powerful, then what does that tell us about Bitcoin? Because Bitcoin and the internet are that same archetype. Humans create language. Humans You know, you could look at a map of how we interact on the internet. It's the same process. And so when you look at it like that, it's more like Bitcoin as a network money is not some crazy innovation that we just can't believe happened. Instead, this was a natural progression, and humans just figured out how to optimize by looking at nature to create technology that mimics nature. So Bitcoin was inevitable.
Do you think it's about a reversal of brainwashing, of indoctrination? Because it's unprecedented. I mean, we've been, you know, I mean, come on, I mean, you know, we've been conditioned for what? At least, you know, this monetary, whatever, Keynesianism, central banking system in collusion with the governments. It's what, 400 years, but actually it's been ongoing. The process has been ongoing for long, you know, it's like almost, you know, over imprinted over our, this natural order, which is, you know, the natural imprint. So do you think this is like a reconditioning to the natural process of how we think, how we incentivize ourselves, you know, because this is what I'm saying. People cannot even imagine what it could be like once Bitcoin, you know, is the monetary root layer, the root structure, the decentralized root structures that is unstoppable, uncontrollable, unconfiscatable, and unmanipulatable, if there's a word for that, right? So
definitely. I would say that it's, if we're going to continue this network intelligence layer, I don't think Keynesian economics or modern central banking are really the forces at play. I think we have to zoom way out. I think it's much bigger. It's really a way to communicate how humans' needs are being met, like the purpose of money. It's a language that's a common language that we all use to coordinate. And all it is we just have a more sophisticated language. And I am so confident in this type of sophisticated language we call Bitcoin or money because it mirrors a evolutionary robust strategy that persists through for so long. And so it really does feel like we finally came up with the right approach here. And just like how the internet or Twitter is like the global brain connecting us, this just removes friction and allows humans to coordinate on a much more sophisticated scale. And it sort of takes away our human weaknesses, right? It prevents us from dominating and from doing the things that we're programmed to do. It sort of tampers that and allows the wisdom of the crowd to guard this money, right? Make it hard to change. And so, yeah, I'm not sure where Keynesian economics comes into this. Besides, that would be a perversion of what is, you could say, more natural. But I don't know if there really is natural money because it's constantly evolved over time. Mm-hmm. But I feel like this is the as good as we're going to get, at least as far as my life is concerned.
Mm-hmm. No, I see, since I see Bitcoin as nature itself, Bitcoin is finite, its supply is finite, but its time will be infinite. And just like nature, it'll just change to ensure its own survival or its inherent permanence like nature. Now, with regards to Keynesianism, you know, if you build something, you know, unnatural on a natural surface, nature is just going to lay waste to it anyway. So it's effectively Keynesianism is building a dam out of clay. One day this dam will go because it's just not natural to try dam something up with clay.
Yeah, it's a great analogy. It reminds me also, like, if we look at plastic, right, we're concerned about all the pollution that our species is creating, which we should be concerned about that. Mm-hmm. However, if you zoom out to a geological timescale, a planetary timescale, in our lifetime, the plastic will be there. However, in the planet's lifetime, let's say humans are wiped out today, everything we've ever created will be completely gone in a blink of an eye based on our planet's capacity to recycle. And so I think it's kind of funny that Keynesianism could even be that plastic that we think in our human timescale lasts so long, but in our species and our planet, it's just a blink of an eye.
George Carlin once said that the human sole purpose of living was to provide the earth with plastic.
Definitely. And if you go back to mycelium with plastic, we're now finding that mycelium can break down plastic. It can break hydrocarbon bonds in oil. It can consume plastic. Right. They're finding new species in the Chernobyl area, and it's consuming radioactive waste, breaking it down, and the byproduct is safe to consume. And so this mycelium, like you said, with Bitcoin, it can teach itself, it can learn, it can adapt, and it can evolve. Mycelium's the same way. It says, holy shit, this radioactive waste, what a powerful food source. Let's send information back to the mushroom scientists. Let's figure out a way to eat this. And now it has incredible food source that nothing else around it can consume. So it carves out, continues to take up space. It's truly amazing.
And you know what's so phenomenal is the adaptation, what we often forget, the adaptation of the human being, of the human physicality, of the human DNA to new environmental conditions such as radioactivity. I mean, that's been proven in studies that it takes time, it takes years, maybe even 10, 20 years, but especially, you know, children, they adapt to new environmental conditions. You know, whether that was, I think there was a documentary on grandma in Chernobyl area, you know, she was living pretty fine after that. You know, I mean, it's amazing. Or, you know, people in Fukushima, it's not, you know, I'm saying it's should be done on a systematic you know, level, but it's, I just think it's phenomenal how human being, human structure, human you know, DNA or information carrier can adapt to that, to those new environmental conditions. So going back to the mycelium, what I really found exciting, what you wrote, is that this practical approach where you, let me show this, which we just talked about offline previously, about this, you said, in this article, let's take a look at the Tokyo subway system to illustrate the power of decentralized networks. Can you go a little bit into detail about this experiment they did?
Yeah, definitely. This is a favorite on Twitter and also for myself. So the slime mold is a organism that used to be considered a fungi, and now scientists found out that it's not technically a fungi. So it left the fungi kingdom, but I hold it close and pretend it still is. But what the Japanese scientists did was they were trying to decide, are these organisms intelligent, right? Because they do demonstrate intelligence. And the way that they did that was created a map of the Tokyo subway system. Each subway stop was a little bit of oat flake, which is the slime mold's favorite food. So it's essentially a maze, and there's little rewards. And then they release the slime mold into the maze. And in about 24 hours, the first 12 hours, let's say, the slime mold extended its tentacles in all directions, growing extremely rapidly until it found all the food. And then the next 12 hours, it reorganized itself to create the most efficient network in order to eat this food and stay connected. And so then they're like, wow, let's look at the map. And to their surprise, they found out that the slime mold created a more efficient and more redundant, so a better subway system than the Japanese engineers could create on their own. And so what does this tell us? Number one, I'm not knocking the Japanese engineers. I'm sure that they were fantastic. However, there's something else here at play, and that is a decentralized intelligence network is a better tool to solve certain problems. Like in this case, you're essentially solving the traveling salesman problem. So a very complex problem, and it would take a really big computer or a quantum computer to effectively solve it. But the slime mold simulates that because it's made up of all these individual parts where they communicate, they talk to each other, but each individual part is making decisions that's best for itself in that moment. So it essentially pushes decision-making to the edge, pushes complexity to the edge. And that's a pretty amazing thing. It also mirrors how we're looking at an information revolution where we used to have these hierarchical organizations where you essentially funnel information to the top, and at the top of the organization, you theoretically have the best decision maker, and all the workers are just gathering information so the king can make decisions. Where now we have the ability where information travels fast, facts are cheap, and more or less instant communication. So you don't need such a vertically integrated organization. In fact, it's more efficient to be more horizontal and let the people communicating with customers, for example, make more decisions because they're the ones who actually have all the information. And so, yeah, all that's to say, Bitcoin also plays by the same rules where information and complexity decision-making is pushed away from the base layer, right? We want to maintain this heartbeat at the center of the network to be as simple, stupid, if you will, as possible, reduce attack surface. And then we can push all the crazy stuff to the second layers, the stuff that's not going to break consensus. And so, Satoshi, in my opinion, was a mycologist. I don't know how else he'd put all this stuff together. And if Satoshi was a mycologist, I'm sure he studied the slime molds and this type of network.
Which again supports Haas' statement previously that it's a natural, what did you say? It's a natural thing, natural order, or it's nature?
Manifestation. It's just the natural manifestation of money. So it's money in nature form. Mm-hmm. But it's also, energy and money form, and energy is nature. And, transitive property of algebra. Bitcoin is energy. Bitcoin is nature. Bitcoin is life. And all natural subsets of that.
If you put that on a time trajectory, where do you see this process, this evolution of, because there's a vision, right? Did you have a vision when, Brandon, when you wrote this or when you elaborated on research for that article, did you have a vision how Bitcoin, extrapolated or materialized sort of would look like, including on a time trajectory? I mean, is it like this or is it,
Like, are you saying growth in terms of cap users, however you want to measure it? Like, would it grow in the same way that like a biological simulation might grow or something like that? Mm-hmm. I haven't personally done much thinking on this. However, I would assume that it follows the same exponential adoption curve that network technologies have, where, you build the base of people and, you continually provide feedback to the product and it gets better and better. And then all of a sudden it goes vertical. And I would assume that Bitcoin follows the same principles. It makes sense for there to be less or only one type of money, just remove friction. And so I think that's at play here. I think actually the hardest part about Bitcoin adoption is that we're all default Keynesians, to take Brady from Citizen Bitcoin's podcast's line there. And so we have this entrenched belief system, and it's really hard to change culture as a species, right? Through our evolutionary biological history, we're all conditioned, we're all programmed to not take too many risks. And so if we look at that programming, no one wants to be the first one to jump out and say, yeah, sure, I'll sell my government money and buy some crazy internet money. And so that middle part, that middle 70% of the population, they're going to change really slow, right? Until you hit the quote tipping point. And I view the current Bitcoiners as like these, you could say Matrix from the Neo, or these autodidacts, these polymaths, these seekers, these curious people. We all have a little rebel spirit in us, right? You can sort of archetype who these people are. We're comfortable going against the grain. We're comfortable at Thanksgiving telling our uncle he's an idiot. That's just like what's being attracted into Bitcoin land right now. And getting out of that sort of ideologically motivated horde that we are now, I think it's slowly starting to happen, right? You see these little glimpses, like U.S. senators saying there's Bitcoin and there's shitcoin. You can't subpoena Satoshi, right? Like, I can't believe this stuff is happening.
Unbelievable, yeah.
And you got Michelle Pham and Russell Okung. We're starting to seep out into culture. And unfortunately, I don't know if the current Bitcoin horde is the right people to convince that middle 70. I think it might take this, like, slow drip down through culture where it needs to be more relatable, even if it's half true. Having these cultural icons blab about Bitcoin might be what it takes, because we come off as raving lunatics sometimes. And I don't know, like, should we be, peddling the red pill on the corner, or should we be building Zion's defense, which I just stole from a Tales from the Crypt podcast recently. That was fantastic. I'm blanking on the episode, but I think that's an interesting point. Like, should we be recruiting one by one, giving out red pills, or should we be hardening the base and, you know, charging, going to mass, right? Like singing the hymns. Yeah, I know you're into that. Or, you know, I'm not sure what that angle is, but I just threw a lot out at you guys.
So I remember you talking about, you know, exponential S-curve technologies that we're used to living with and seeing. But do you know who invented the S-curve?
No.
Nature.
No.
So all throughout the billions of years, you have slow population growth, you know, and it's got extinction risk at all periods of its growth. And then eventually it finds its niche, population explodes, and then the top flattens out. Now, once the tops flatten out, you either have sudden extinction. It happens numerous cases over the past 3 billion years. Or you get a little burst of improvement that takes you up to the next level of the S, and so on and so forth. And that's what's going to happen with Bitcoin. We've seen that happen. S curve go and keep going. And I think we're at the very, very bottom of the flat Bitcoin S curve. Once people figure out that they do need to shift to our S curve or risk extinction, people will shift over, and we'll be ready for them with good plug and play solutions, more innovation on the base layer, more innovation on the second and third and fourth layers. So I think, again, it's self-interest and survival instinct in all of these. When people see it and, you know, see that, you know, maybe they should be happier with a job than with savings.
Okay, I was just going to mention that. But okay, when we talk about like survival, I'm like, if people don't get it right now in these crazy times, I don't know when. But
all right, but when you hear shit like that, maybe you have to start thinking about your survival, don't you?
Yeah.
Haas, I think you should just be thankful that you have some employment. You're stepping out of line.
Yeah, exactly. Be happy. You know, I mean, you're a slave. You're, you know, you pay taxes. Be happy. You know that you are serving. You know, the very few at the, I don't know, tip of the pyramid. So
you don't need a savings account, Haas. Definitely not. As long as you work 8 hours a day for the rest of your life, you're fine. You'll be able to eat. It might be insects that you're eating, but you'll be fine. You should be grateful.
Will be difficult to find a job that's only 8 hours a day.
Harvesting insects.
Yeah.
But it really takes a sociopathic arrogance, a degree of arrogance, or I don't know, the assumption from Lagarde. Is she already officially now the ECB president of the European Central Bank?
I think there's like still more, like two or three more weeks of overlap between her and Draghi before she officially takes the reins. But she's effectively, you know, active. Active head.
Okay. It says incoming ECB president.
So she's still got a few more weeks of overlap with her and Draghi, but you know, effectively, you can take this statement as coming from the head of the ECB. Okay. Be happy with a job, slave. Leave the savings to us.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, she is herself let me just say a puppet. I mean, she was chosen deliberately for this position because she does exactly what she's, you know, commanded to, what do you call it, like asked to do. Otherwise, she wouldn't be in that position. But having the arrogance and the, what do you call it, chutzpah, to say something like that. I mean, it should be, I don't know, why doesn't this statement make people think or, you know, start thinking?
Much shit about Lagarde and they cut him off. Oh no, here we are. We got him back.
It's unstable. It says it's not stable, my internet connection. So, okay.
Did you get a chance to hear what I just said?
No, please. Can you repeat that?
I said you were talking too much shit about the ECB, so they cut your connection.
It's no coincidence. It's not the first time, you know, but, you know, I can't help it.
Synchronicity, as Gigi would say.
Yeah, you better put your VPN back on.
Yeah, no. I can slow down even much more my bandwidth. So if we want to try to tie it a little bit together, all these, you know, external events, the pressure, the all these, you know, geopolitical, macroeconomical, and then maybe come back maybe to the mycelium, to the essence of mycelium, is that when things happen, when conditions are created that put pressure on the collective of this decentralized network. This is what I'm asking. I know I'm repeating sometimes myself, but do you think this would accelerate the going forwards to that tipping point, Brandon? I mean, in you know, especially in the case of, you know, extrapolating the mycelium philosophy on Bitcoin.
Yeah, definitely. Good question. We are definitely in a strange time and sort of the macro conditions. I feel like every time I open up a browser on Twitter, there's another country rioting. And it's cool to watch them sharing tips. Like I saw one today, I think it was in Chile. They were jumping on top of the armored sort of like tanks that shoot water guns. And some guy was deadlifting the water gun right off the top of the car and then jumping off. And apparently they're learning. So anyways, that's what I was doing earlier today. The question is the macro conditions, they're getting strange. And how does Bitcoin play in? And I would say that Bitcoin, you know, straight from Nassim Taleb, it is anti-fragile. So it does gain from the chaos. It's built for that. Whereas centrally planned systems by design, they cannot prepare for the chaos, right? It's impossible to plan for. And so when you look in that condition, I would say Bitcoin is suited really well. And if we want to look at how mycelium handles complexity or handles chaos, I think that's a pretty useful analogy. And so if you think about a forest floor, just beneath the forest floor, there is a incredible battle going on 24/7, microbiology fighting microbiology, whether it's fungi, bacteria, insects, all this stuff is competing for a finite number of resources. And how is it that a one cell walled root structure, which we call mycelium, how does it survive in such hostile conditions? And the answer is because it can evolve and it creates custom enzymes to defend itself. So it's constantly spreading its tentacles, sensing its environment, sharing information bidirectionally, sharing resources. And if a threat comes up, information sent back throughout the organism, it creates a new custom enzyme, lock and key, to handle that threat. And in the process, okay, it handles that threat, but it also learns something. It keeps that new enzyme in its chemical library for future predators. And over time, this effect compounds. And so with an organism like that, it's constantly learning, adapting, gaining new tools. Chaos is no problem, right? In that environment, mycelium will outcompete chaos all day long. And so it sort of gets hardened from that complexity. And I think Bitcoin was designed the same way. Over the long enough term, I'm, you know, nearly 100% confident in Bitcoin's success. However, in let's say there was some sort of financial crisis globally now, today, how would Bitcoin perform? I'm less confident on that. I would say I think the longer we delay this financial crisis, the better for Bitcoin. If we had a 2008 type situation today, I think Bitcoin would go down with the ship. But I think it would slowly rebuild and come out stronger and eventually take market share from the global finance market. However, yeah, I would like to see a little more QE, give Bitcoin a little more time, and, you know, let these tentacles get a little bit stronger, and, you know, a few more politicians speaking out, a few more celebrities speaking out. And because we really, really, really do want rich, powerful people to buy Bitcoin today, because they're the people who will push back against the government when the government says, hey, give up all your Bitcoin or it's illegal, right? And so the longer we're under the radar, the longer we're sort of underappreciated, the better, right? So government hubris is our friend.
Totally agree. It's necessary for the soft landing. I think if institutions and all of those guys, you know, roll up now and make the price moon, you know, old hodlers, you know, would be happy. But, you know, then the power is back with the bastards. So hopefully price can stay low for a while and let the little guy stack as much as possible. And what did you mean by go down with the ship precisely, as in like see the price plummet to zero?
Oh, no. Temporarily go down. Like we just have like another prolonged bear market.
$1,000?
I have no idea on the price.
Because I'm telling you, there's enough holders of last resort. He's just waiting stack. No, because there's enough holders of last resort that like there is a floor, like a floor price for Bitcoin. If the system is functioning and Bitcoin is working, there's always people with cash. Always.
Yeah, I wholeheartly agree with that. It would be more
it's
like
so small now and requires so little money to like maintain its floor price that like I seriously don't think like if the stock market were to drop 30%, I wouldn't like even if Bitcoin drops 60%, like that's not a drop for Bitcoin. We eat 60% for breakfast. But a 30% drop in the stock market will ruin the world.
Well, no, you're absolutely right.
Won't ruin Bitcoin.
No, you're right. Bitcoin's tiny. I guess I made that comment because there's a narrative that Bitcoin is going to be counter-cyclical to the markets or negatively correlated to mainstream finance. And I just don't know. I don't know how true that is. Bitcoin's fine. Just it's not going to gain. It's not going to. The stock market's not going to go down and Bitcoin's going to go up in lockstep. I just don't see that happening.
Yeah, just as Carlin would say, the planet is fine. It's the people that are fucked. Same thing with Bitcoin. Bitcoin is fine. It's fiat that is fucked. So Bitcoin's always going to be here, whether fiat collapses or not. That's it. It's digital nature. Unless you turn off the digital world, which you can't now. Because like mycelium, there's, too many things depending on it for its own survival to let it die. So I think just the mycelium nature of Bitcoin brings inherent defense to Zion.
And, after nearly...
Social defense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And after nearly 11 years... It's just, the cat is out of the bag, as I always say, or the genie is out of the bottle, whatever expression you want to use. It's just too many of us that have convictions, really strong convictions and trust. I mean, maybe we can talk about, this. Have you, if I may mention that, when are you planning to publish your article, which I had the honor to, read the draft has?
That's now pending release in the Bitcoin Times. So I think we're all waiting on Dan Held to write his piece. Shout out to Dan.
Shout out to Dan Held.
That should be coming out hopefully in the next week or so.
Yeah, it's a great masterpiece.
So, target release was late October, early November. So maybe I'll have to come back a few months after that one goes out and we'll have another chat.
Yeah. All right. So what I was going to say is, it's already too many of us who have really strong convictions, knowledge, comprehension, and I always say trust, because trust is knowing, like in the being. And I think we're still in this phase of, hoping, wishing. I don't know. It feels like it, that there's more and more momentum building up for other people that are coming into this Noah's boat, whatever you call it. So we shouldn't take it for granted. I think it's a process and experience of a lot of people that have been going, going in into from different angles or different rabbit holes. Each of us has like a different path of finding oneself, like making it click, like the aha moment.
Absolutely. Gigi wrote a fantastic
shout out to him
a couple of days ago. So I was very glad to be in Riga around the time Gigi had his religious breakthrough. I totally agree with you. The rabbit hole isn't really a hole. It's more like a canyon. So there's several ways to jump into the canyon. Like you're not restricted through that small little hole that you have to burrow in. It's just It's there, the Rabbit Canyon. Find it anywhere you like.
Is there anything? Is there anything, guys, that that has changed for you from your perspective, from your comprehension level? Like you're saying, you know, you would say to yourself, "Oh, you know, this is like totally changed." From your perspective, from your understanding, in the last few years. Like right to the essence of Bitcoin, like where we would say, oh, why didn't I get that, like, you know, a few months or a few years ago?
Yeah, for me it was the spiritual stuff. Putting it all together in you know how there's that P equal NP problem or whatever the hell the tech guys talk about. For me it was the linking of Bitcoin is so capital B Bitcoin is equal to capital E energy, and lowercase b Bitcoin is equal to lowercase e energy. When I was able to connect those two and have like my spiritual revelation based on those facts, I went from there, because capital E energy is effectively synonymous with the universe. It is all mass. It's all, you know, mass and energy that's ever existed. Finite, infinitely divisible. Bitcoin, capital B, finite, lowercase b, infinitely divisible. And since everything is nature and Bitcoin is energy, Bitcoin is everything. So when I was able to link that in my, you know, religious enlightenment rabbit hole experience, that's probably when my life changed. So it's been just over 3 years since that trip down the rabbit hole. Literally in the rabbit hole. So I was lucky enough to be sitting in the Master's Garden at Christ Church in Oxford, and yeah, that's where Alice in Wonderland was written. So I was very, very, very lucky to have had my revelation there.
Awesome, lightning. Brandon, you were gonna say something?
Yeah, I forgot what I was actually going to say a moment ago, but it's really hard for me. This question gets asked a lot on podcasts, like what's a recent revelation or what really clicked for you? And I can't really pick one besides it mirrors nature, right? That was obviously the big one for me. We've already talked about it. However, there's so many. It's like constantly my mind is blown with Bitcoin. And seeing how different people approach this same question or what is Bitcoin from their own lens, right? We all have our own sum total of experiences that make up our perspective. And to the banker, it's finance rails. To the mycologist, it's holy shit, it's a mushroom, you know, right? From all these different angles, it's different things. And so one recent one that actually two comments come to mind. One is the article, Bitcoin is a Decentralized Clock. I'm sure you guys have read this one. I thought it was
I haven't actually.
Which one? Oh man, you're going to like this one. I think it's called Bitcoin is a Decentralized Clock.
Who's the author? Do you know the author?
Gwurm, maybe. If you Google that, you'll find it. But
okay.
It's essentially looking at the history of time. And this guy, I forgot who it was, he essentially figured out like the essence of Bitcoin is not just money, or it's not just a messaging system or whatever. It's actually a clock. And so the hard problem measuring time is that we don't actually measure objective time, right? So if you think about the history of time and clocks, we would use the sun or the moon or the planets, and that's how we would measure time. And then we created mechanical clocks, and we'd have wristwatches, and there'd be one main clock in London standard time. So all the people would come to the city, they'd see the one clock that everyone coordinates off, they'd set their wristwatch to the London time, and then they'd leave and they'd come back a week later and their clock was all messed up, because we're using mechanics to try and measure time, right? So it's not perfect. And then we created atomic clocks, which is the decay of atoms, which we follow relatively consistently. It's much better than mechanical time. And he essentially takes this article into, okay, Bitcoin is a way to tell time. You tell time in blocks. And so it's not necessarily a individual unit that's consistent, but you have this relative time. And this relative time on our planet coordinates, and we all sync up on this one time. And so that's sort of a really, really gross explanation of this guy's article, but very mind-blowing. And it's cool to look at Bitcoin not as money, right? And it could be so much more. Like, I think this thing, I think we're just monkeys poking it with a stick at this point, to be completely honest. Like, yes, it's money. And the fact that it's money will incentivize people to explore it more and to bolt things on and see how we can leverage it more. But I think it's much more than that.
The absolute scarcity, can we talk about it? Because you've mentioned it again, the finite supply. Would you say that this is something so unprecedented in human history that it would change a lot of things, a lot of other things, this absolute scarcity of Bitcoin with 21 million in connection with time? Is that something that will, like, I don't know, create totally new structures?
I think it's a fundamentally useful tool to have the ability to use a scarce asset, right? We don't have any way to do that. Gold's pretty scarce. A lot of people talk about Monsieur Robert Breedlove, et cetera, how Bitcoin and time are the only scarce things on our planet. And from that perspective, why would you want to work for something that's not scarce, right? You spend scarce resources, which is time, and you earn a non-scarce resource. And we're supposed to be thankful for that. And I think that's just madness, right? And it's not just like, hey, I want my work to be meaningful and I want to have more money or something. It's more like on a population scale, on a whole human scale, it's really inefficient if we work and we don't retain the capital, right? We want the people who create value to retain capital and then allocate that capital. That's better for everyone. And so having this fundamentally scarce resource, it just signals, it's just a tool to signal what to create and the right people to create it. And that is going to make humanity better. And that's fantastic.
And it's a totally deflationary money, right, Hess? I mean,
You mentioned something about the scarcity giving us the option to build new structures. I think the scarcity aspect is the first time that we're now allowed to set clear boundaries. And by boundaries, you can also call it lines in the sand. So economic fair play boundaries. And then the structures will be built within those boundaries. So you've got a boundary of, this is your finite resource set, build your structures accordingly. So for example, the world fiat and banking structure is boundless. There are no boundaries, or controls on it, whereas Bitcoin provides the ultimate boundary, 21 million coins, build your structures with that in mind.
I like that. It's also a interesting way to say there's a game we all play, right? The game is to increase our personal standing in the world, let's say. And in order to play the game effectively, you want to know the rules. And once everybody knows the rules, we all play the game and the best player win, right? But what happens when the rules change all the time? And you segment certain people with separate rules, then you leave and there's new rules and they change all the rules again. Every generation, there's new rules. That's very, very disruptive. And it causes not only personal and our small human units, that causes tremendous damage, but also causes damage on our species. Like, we need to have one set of rules, which is Bitcoin. This is the game. We're trying to get as many of these fucking Satoshis as we can. And if everybody knows the game, we'll play the game. And okay, let's extrapolate this. Now that we have a fair game, it's going to channel the energy, channel the action, the intentions of humans to do what we're best at, to build things, make tools, make our life better, et cetera. And channeling that like a laser is going to increase productivity on our planet tremendously. Think about all the people that are not part of the financial system, or their money is inflated away so they can't really contribute. That's causing harm to everyone. I forgot who said the quote, but it's, we were promised flying cars and all we got was 280 characters. I think that's just a fantastic line, because once we've created this culture of dopamine, essentially we're all addicted to dopamine, and that distracts us from long-term planning, long-term goals. Our money's in the same category there. What if we removed all that? What if we did focus long-term? Would we be in space? Would we have far better structures on our planet here? Like, we should be in the outer reaches of our own solar system by now. Instead, we're nowhere. We're watching Netflix and living for the moment, and we should be grateful to eat bugs and work our whole life. Like, these things are insane. Bitcoiners realize this. We also sound insane trying to explain this to someone who's like, no, everything's cool. What are you talking about?
And psychologically, emotionally, socially, it takes away the fear of people, finally, because when you have a value, when you have a money that is disinflationary, that actually grows in value, you know, I just tweeted recently, like, imagine a child or a kid, you know, going into a toy store and buying, you know, a toy, and then, you know, maybe a year later, you know, you can buy with that same one Satoshi, with that one single Satoshi, let's say, I don't know, 10 times more toys or products. I mean, this is unprecedented. You don't, you know, people then, once they don't have the fear of losing value, of losing wealth, of losing their existential, you know, freedom, I think that does something to humanity, to society in at large. What do you think, Hass?
You know, as long as people are grateful for their jobs, but I see that's all part of the natural S-curve, right? And people will choose to join the S-curve where they like, but the people who don't join it are headed for sure extinction. So you know, more and more people, you know, will tack onto it. As more people tack onto it, it'll become more disinflationary, yet more stable, and it's just the self-fulfilling property, just like the mycelia at Chernobyl, right? There's no one else in the market, and the way this thing operates is just, it swallows up the market, and I think Bitcoin will mirror that.
Indeed. Yeah, self-fulfilling prophecy. What a great thing. Let me wrap this up. What is it? Is there something that right now at this juncture, people do you have a feeling people are understanding more?
Like, I think they will soon. I think memes are very powerful things. I love memes. I loved and wasted countless, maybe thousands of hours looking at memes over the better part of a decade and a half. And Bitcoin is a solid meme. Religion is also probably a very, very solid meme. So combine those two memes together, and it's very strong. But on the other side, memes like Lagarde, I imagine things like these will catch on more and more and more over the next years. And these memes are just as beneficial to Bitcoin as our, you know, Bitcoin shitposting memes. And I think as more people tack on to, like, the deep-seated, like, corruption at bank. So you can be at home, like, you've come home from a hard day's work. You've been on the tools for 12 hours. You know, you've got bills to worry about and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And you're saying, you know what, that's just the way of the world. That's, you know, how we're all living. And then you turn the TV on and you see this lady speaking from a tower so ivory that it's blinding in direct sunlight, saying you should be thankful for your job and don't worry. And, you know, we save your money so you don't have to. I think memes like this, and they will become, memes like this will be more and more frequently occurring as the QE taps keep going and the arguments, you know, people just putting their hand up and saying, where the hell is all my money going? Like, you know, I used to be able to buy a kilo of meat for $7 a few years ago. Now I'm paying $20 a kilo. Like, you know, my wage hasn't gone up 70%. And now, you know, I'm supposed to be happy that I even got a job. Like, that's enough for me to want to go start a revolution. But I already joined the revolution about 6 years ago. So I'm set for my revolutionary roadmap.
The opt-out, the opt-out revolution.
I love that. I think you touched on a couple of things that I was going to mention as well. One is that it's really easy to be pessimistic if you look at just general markers geopolitically around the world. And now we have the ability to spy on anyone's backyard. And so we can actually, it's really hard for humans to grapple with all the shit that's going on around the planet. And there's a general sense that it's getting worse, and that's probably stemming from inequalities that most average people feel. And so when I think about Bitcoin, you mentioned the word the revolution, and I think that it absolutely is. I think Bitcoin is sort of like the rallying cry for the revolutionaries. It's the flag in the sand. It's the nucleus that draws people in. And I think it's going to be more than Bitcoin. I think it's going to be privacy, taking our data back, you know, not eating bugs, eating real food, all these things kind of come together. It's just sort of the counterforce to what's sort of manifested in our culture today. And for me personally, I used to be much more politically motivated, try to change the system, you know, get the right, if only we elect the right guy in the office, mm-hmm. everything will be good. And that is the biggest lie imaginable. And I think once I realized that that's not the game, right? We're not changing this game from the inside. It's derelict. It's past. Instead, let's build our own system, right? Very cyberpunk ethos, which I didn't know at the time. But Bitcoin's given me tremendous optimism. It's where all the political energy goes now. I don't give a shit when the politicians say crazy things or they do this or do that. You know, whatever, the system's going to break, and hopefully we build something better to replace it in as short of time as possible. And hopefully it doesn't harm as many people as it could without Bitcoin. And so for me, it's very optimistic. That's sort of the political side. Let's put that aside for a second. The other thing, talking about, looking at the future and adoption and memes and what is this thing? Where are we? I think a really, really important one that's not really talked about a lot is how millennials, they don't want to save, right? There's no reason to save. And we could look at this as a cultural thing. It could be related to money slipping out between their hands. I'm not exactly sure where it is. However, I think Bitcoin does make saving sexy, right? You made that comment about the little kid. If you teach a kid, you get one toy today or two toys tomorrow. Most kids are still going to take one toy, but I think that lesson itself is powerful enough where young people, the millennial generation, which are stepping into power in the United States, generally young people are on the rise. And if they have this opportunity where the stock market's out of reach, there's no point to buy that. They can't afford a house. The jobs really aren't there. We're drowning in student debt, all these things. Bitcoin's really, really, really the only way out for the average young person. And so I think the meme of making saving sexy or stacking sats is sexy, whatever. If we can sort of shift that narrative from live for today and instead, just look at the chart. If you show the chart to a kid, like, we understand greed. Humans fundamentally understand saving for tomorrow. It's built into us, right? If you kill the antelope, and you don't eat it all, you need to preserve it, smoke it or ferment it or do something. Like, humans have been doing this forever. And it just sort of feels now that there's this general air of hopelessness for young people. And make saving sexy and rally around Bitcoin. I think those are truly powerful forces that I'm not sure where this is going to go. And Gigi says we're already there. Some people say we're already on the way up, all these things. I don't know. But I think those two forces are powerful enough to take this thing, an order of magnitude higher without too much trouble.
And the thing is, even if it goes up an order of magnitude, so this is how I think about it. I think there's probably only maybe 100,000 max holders of last resort.
Max.
So, max. So at this price point, to keep the price stable, it's only $16 million a day. So if there was actually 1 million holders of last resort, you think they couldn't cough up 16 bucks a day? Right. Easy. So there's not that many holders of last resort. So it's got space to go up another 5 orders of magnitude. From 100,000 to 1 million to 10 million, 100 million, billion. Like there's a lot of room. So we're not talking order of magnitude. Like we're talking several orders. So like Bitcoin Twitter's a bubble. There are no daily sat stackers. If there was a decent amount, if there was 1 million, 5 million, 10 million people putting in, you know, 10 bucks a day, if there was 10 million putting in 10 bucks a day, the price of a Bitcoin would be $90,000.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I like that model. I also like
that many people. And it's not even that many people. 10 bucks a day for 10 million people isn't even that many people. So that's why, like, don't even worry about order of magnitude. Worry about 4 or 5.
Yeah.
I really like the tithing Bitcoin that you came up with, Haas. I think that's a perfect way to look at it. Just set it a little bit here, a little bit there. Just pay your dues. I think that's a fantastic way to look at it. Go ahead.
Because the stability. So like you'll talk to any charity, they'll say, look, we'd rather you commit 20 bucks a month than give us 500 bucks cash right now, because we can rely on that cash flow. For the unbanked to be able to rely on Bitcoin, they need to rely on, you know, the selfless tithers that are happy to absorb the market and hold the market. And like I'm telling you, there's probably max 100,000 of those people right now.
Crazy.
Yeah, that solves a lot of Bitcoin's problems too. Smoothing out the volatility. Also minimize risk.
I said it on Rapid Fire. If you want the price to be stable, you got to put your nuts on the table.
Yeah, nuts on the table.
So you got to be willing to risk things. Like if we're serious about a revolution, people have to take revolutionary steps.
Yeah. It goes back to that, you know, trust and conviction and real knowing that this is happening, and it's by order of magnitude.
The power of the believers stems from their faith in each other.
Yeah.
And currently, I've got faith that about 20 to 50 million people share my faith. They don't share my hodl and the daily stacking, but at least they share the faith. And effectively is faith. Like I need to have faith that you're going to take my Bitcoin. And you need to have faith that I'm going to take yours. Well, not, you know, confiscate, like accept when you pay me. And, the strength of Bitcoin will come from the faith that the believers have in each other.
Right.
So Bitcoin is a faithless system. You don't need to have faith in Bitcoin. Bitcoin works. Bitcoin is energy, nature, and life. But we need to have faith in each other if we're gonna make it as a species in a survival respect. Don't worry about Bitcoin. Bitcoin will survive.
Now, Brandon, you said something previously, you know, like, because I mean, you know, I'm not the only one. So many people, even I think Safed and Amos talked about this, like, you know, going to the voting booths, you know, when it's election day, people, I mean, there's more and more people, I think, like me, you know, totally not going to vote anymore. You know, it just, you know, I'm not nurturing the system anymore. It's illogical. You're supporting the system. It doesn't matter whatever color, party, whatever it is. So I wish that would happen in synchronicity, with the ever growing number of hodlers of last resort, you know, not going to the voting, voting booths or something like that. So, because it doesn't change anything. This is the problem people don't understand. They think whatever every 4 years or whatever time frame in intervals people are going into the you know this and that party or always the same party, it doesn't matter. It doesn't change anything in within the system. So we got to opt out of it. And if 30, 40, 50% of the population wouldn't go voting anymore, then I think that would really, a shockwave would go through the system. And then eventually that would breed a new, mycelium root structure.
The shockwave will come if those 30 million people, instead of rocking up to the voting booth that day, still leave the house, still go on a trip, but go down to the Bitcoin ATM booth. If you can get 30 million people down there, that'd be a shockwave. But in Australia, we've got mandatory voting actually. So
really,
we don't actually have to vote. We just got to go down and cross our names off the list.
Wow, I didn't know that.
So that's interesting. Down, cross our names off the list. If we don't cross our name off the list, it's like a $90 fine.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, but it's not illegal to put in an empty ballot. It's not illegal to, write in.
Yeah.
Can not illegal to, write whatever you want on the, on the vote and put it in. Obviously, it won't count for anything. But yeah, unless you go down to vote, you get fined in Australia.
This is, that's something.
And federal elections.
Amazing.
That's
amazing.
Crazy. Yeah. So I've got an idea that just came to me during this conversation.
Yes.
Before I get to that, one, it's funny, Australia's mandatory voting. In the US, people are trying to prevent the opposing base for voting. That's funny. But the new campaign I just came up with, let's see if this thing sticks, is, how there's a meme where it's like, vote with your dollar, right? It's sort of the same thing we're talking about. You can't change the politician. Don't regulate Walmart. Just shop somewhere else, right? Everyone knows this. What if on election day in the U.S., which I think will be a very turbulent time, roughly 1 year from today, a little more than that, what if instead of saying the I voted sticker, we have a campaign where it's like I stacked and everyone votes, but you vote with your dollar. You vote with your Bitcoin. So let's create stickers that say I stacked or I voted for whatever we want to call it. I think I stacked is probably the move. But
okay, let's tie together.
I totally agree. And, putting your nuts on the table is just another way of saying putting your money where your mouth is. And, if you're actually with it and you're a revolution, I'm not telling you to abandon the fiat system altogether, although I do greatly respect people that make that move, like Max Hillebrand made that move very, very recently, that he's no longer going to participate in the fiat system.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote an article about the various types of religious characters in Bitcoin. Max would be, way up there. But even for the casual churchgoers, put your money where your mouth is. Put a couple of Satoshi in the hat when it's getting passed around. If you want the revolution to succeed, you must put your money where your mouth is. And it's not just a US problem, it's an international problem. The people with their money put it behind their mouth, and they do that to back a politician and to influence a politician. But never underestimate the power of a group of powerless people.
Exactly. So I've been thinking before the podcast, so like, what could be like the perfect meme as a title for our talk, like to make it really effective, like emotionally touching or, picking up the people where they are. Now I got a couple of inspirations. Thank you so much. Okay. So to wrap this up, what would you say, what would be like the spontaneous meme for you? To put it as a title, guys, Brent has.
Don't trip. Stack sats for salvation.
I would change that and say do trip.
Yeah.
Trip responsibly and stack.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I love that. Okay, now we got it. Got it, got it, got it. Okay, guys. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our talk. It's really inspirational every time. I hope we can repeat this. Maybe next time with Ben Prentice. He's going to miss this, but I'm sure he's going to listen to it. And maybe we can, you know, take another angle. And yeah, so I'll have a good sleep tonight and process everything we talked about.
Yeah, I'm working on a 90-minute Bitcoin talk.
Really?
So I'll be on PowerPoint all day today presenting in 2 weeks. So it should be fun.
All right. Well, Brandon, thanks awesome. So much for breaking everything down, for sharing your thoughts and knowledge, and has, you know, for your salvation. Keep it up. Great work.
I will do. My absolute pleasure.
All right.
Yeah, appreciate it, guys. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, love hanging out. Take care of yourselves.
Catch you soon. Okay. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Welcome to the podcast show by Keevan Devani, The Total Connector, Total Bitcoin, Austin Economics, the hardest and scarcest money ever created in human history, Bitcoin.